Our reading this morning comes from Ecclesiastes chapter 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run into the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has been already in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem. I applied my heart to seek and to search out wisdom, all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after the wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after the wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation. And he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. This is the word of the Lord. Amen. In January, as most of y'all know by now, my mom was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and I went back to Tennessee to be with her when she got that news. And as I was driving her home from the hospital, she started being mom, you know, worrying about me, not wanting to be a bother. And she said, "You know, it's good to see you, but you didn't have to drive all this way just for this." And she took the news of her cancer with so little expression that I just stopped and I looked at her and said, "Mom, do you know how sick you are?" And she said, "Well, I must have been sick. They put me in the hospital." I said, "No, I'm not saying how sick you were. Do you understand how sick you are right now?" And then she changed voices and said, "Yes, Ricky, I know." And I said, "Well, I didn't know what to say," right? I'm like, okay, I wasn't ready for that answer. Didn't know where this conversation was going when I started it. So I said, "Well, are you ready for this?" And she said, "Well, I think I've been getting ready for this my whole life." I've told y'all, some of y'all, that story before, and it just, ever since I heard those words, they've kind of haunted me. I just keep playing them over and over in my mind, wondering, how have you been getting ready for this your whole life? And as I've studied this book of Ecclesiastes, getting ready to kind of launch into it with you this summer, the memory that's come to my mind is of how my mom used to always take me to cemeteries. I can tell you, the way she has gotten ready for this her whole life was growing up, she took us to cemeteries. And it wasn't like just for funerals. Every birthday, every Father's Day, every Mother's Day, every Memorial Day, every big holiday, part of the holiday tradition was going to the cemeteries and putting flowers on graves. That's just what you do in small towns. And as I look back on it, I realized that was her preaching a very loud, clear, and sobering sermon to me and to herself. She was saying, "These are your people, and this is where you're going. This is where you will end up." She was basically looking at me and saying, "Are you ready?" And I say all that to tell you this. I think that is the kind of conversation that the writer of Ecclesiastes wants to have to us. He wants to explain life to us. He wants to tell us how to avoid the potholes that he himself has fallen into. He wants to tell us how to live the good life now without pouring out our best days on a race that we will not win. And that's a hard lesson. It's a hard message. Grown-up messages usually are. He has to disabuse us of the notion that there's some kind of secret to life. He has to take away this idea that there's a brass ring out there, and if you can reach it, if you can get to it, then you will have fulfillment. He has to show us the emptiness of every ambition. The ambition for knowledge, for wisdom, for the perfect family, for love, for pleasure, for success, for money, for power. He has to disabuse us of those ambitions and force us to face the bitter folly of chasing after those things. And then he uses very simple truths. He teaches us a very simple truth. Enjoy the life you have. It's a gift from God. And wait upon the judge to make things right. It's a hard message. It's a message that breaks our heart before it sets us free. But it is one that is important for us to embrace. And that's what we're going to be looking at this summer. We're doing this differently. We're studying the wisdom of Solomon this summer. We've studied Solomon's life for the last 3 weeks. And you'll remember, in the first week, we talked about Solomon, and we talked about how he was worshiping, and God appeared to him, and he said, "Ask me anything, and I will give it to you." And Solomon said, I want wisdom. I want to know how to lead these people. I'm not ready to be the king. And God was pleased with his request, and he said, "You didn't ask for the life of your enemies. You did not ask for wealth. You did not ask for long life. And since you didn't ask for any of those things, I will give those to you. And I will give you wisdom. I will make you wise, more wise than anyone who's come before you or anyone who's will come after you." And in our minds, what happened then was God waved his magic wand and said, ding, and all of a sudden Solomon, you know, kind of did that and went, "Wait a minute, E does equal MC squared. I've got it." But as we read over his life, what we find out is that Solomon still made terrible decisions. He made life-changing, foolish decisions. We studied them last week of chasing after pleasure and of giving up the truth of the gospel. And he doomed his entire nation by his poor decision-making, and he wrecked a large part of his life. And what we see is, as we put those two things together, those two pieces of information that seem the opposite, we see that the way God made Solomon the wisest of all was by giving him access to all the foolishness so that he could see that wealth would not bring happiness, that pleasure would not bring happiness, that wisdom would not bring happiness. He would have to see it. And he could tell us the way of wisdom. Now, as we jump into this book, I just want to kind of look at the problem of Ecclesiastes, give you a little bit of an overview, and then we're going to jump into the first chapter. And I put in the outline, an overview, a trip to the junkyard. And what I mean by that is this. When I was in college, I remember a teacher starting off a Bible study by talking about going out to the junkyard. He had to go drop a lot of stuff off that weekend, and he took his children with him. And he said, at one point, I just grabbed my kids and I said, "You see those rusted out junk cars? Those all made somebody really happy one day. You see those refrigerators? Somebody thought that was awesome once. You see these televisions? Somebody was so happy to get them one. All those things that you think are so important, they're going to end up here. You just need to know that." I think that's the tone of voice that the writer of Ecclesiastes has. See, this is a difficult book for Christians. It's difficult for a lot of reasons, but mainly because we're trying to figure out the tone of voice that he's using, right? I mean, his first words, meaningless. I mean, just think of all the ways you can say this, right? Meaningless, meaningless. Everything is meaningless. I mean, we kind of get this picture of Kurt Cobain or some, you know, tortured artist who's just at the end of his life, weeping, about to commit suicide. It's all meaningless. And we think, well, wait a minute. Why is that in the Bible? Christians aren't supposed to think that way. As a matter of fact, a lot of Christians over the centuries have argued that this book doesn't belong in the Bible. They want to take it out. How in the world could a Christian say everything was meaningless? And largely the reason for that is because ever since Martin Luther and John Calvin, we kind of have a different way of reading the Bible. They're the ones who invented verse-by-verse exposition. Y'all know what, you know, expository teaching verse-by-verse is. I get asked about once a month, do you ever preach expositionally? I think so. I thought I did, but evidently not, since you're asking the question. That's the kind of teaching that we all have learned a lot from, where you just go over one verse and you talk about everything that verse possibly means, and then you go to the next verse. And that is a great way to study Romans. You know, that is a powerful and important way to study the book of Galatians. But if you do that to Ecclesiastes, you're probably going to want to give up and, you know, leave your wife and drive off on a motorcycle. I mean, you spend all day talking about meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless. At some point, you get the message and want to quit. That's not how you read Ecclesiastes. Literary figures have understood that, actually. They love it. Oddly enough, I would say it's fair to say that Ecclesiastes is the book that Christians have disliked the most and unbelievers like the most. They love it. A friend of mine shared this quote with me this week. She said, it's from Thomas Wolfe, an early 20th century author, who said, "For all I have ever seen or learned, Ecclesiastes seems to me the noblest, the wisest, and the most powerful expression of man's life upon this earth, and also the highest flower of poetry, eloquence, and truth. I'm not given to dogmatic judgments in the matter of literary creation, but if I had to make one, I would say this. Ecclesiastes is the greatest single piece of writing I have ever known, and the wisdom expressed in it the most lasting and profound." Now, why would an author say that? Well, because he gets it. You have to read the whole thing at once. It's one poem. It's one sermon. It takes exactly 33 minutes to read it out loud. I came in here on Thursday and stood right here and read it just to see. And if you read it all as one sermon, then all of a sudden you're like, oh, vanity, vanity, all things are vanity. That's his introductory statement. That's not the entire point for the first sermon on it, right? And he's getting us to a place. He's taking us somewhere that's important. And it's a message that is beautifully and painfully written. And to get to that message, we have to ask a few questions. We have to ask, who wrote it? How? What was his tone? And why did he write it? Okay? So let's just go through those. It sounds boring, but we'll do it quickly. Who wrote it? Well, as you can tell from the first 10 minutes here, I think Solomon wrote it, sort of. Solomon sort of wrote it. Like the first verse, it says, the king's son, right? The son of David, the king. Well, that's Solomon. Would also be pretty much any king that came after him. And he talks about how he's wiser than all who's come before him. So that's clearly Solomon. But then there's also things where he says, like, I have amassed more wealth than any king who was before me in Jerusalem. Now, if that's Solomon, why would he bother to say that? There's only been one other king before him in Jerusalem. He clearly thinks he's comparing himself to somebody. And the other times he calls himself the preacher and the teacher. It's just, and there's other things that I don't have time to go into because I don't really understand them, like the Hebrews late, blah, blah, blah. You don't care about that. But this is how I basically have come to grips with. This is what I think. Solomon, we know from 1 Kings, wrote thousands and thousands of Proverbs. He wrote books, tons of books.
And the best way to think about this is it is a sermon based on Solomon's life and teachings. Somebody found those books, went through them. We know that. That's what Proverbs talks about, all of Hezekiah's men going through the teachings of Solomon. And they write this sermon based on his life, based on his teachings. It's his wisdom put together by someone later. He puts it all in order for us. He's come along and he's taken this beauty and this tragedy of Solomon's life, and he set it out to draw one major lesson. And what is that lesson? Well, he's saying meaning cannot be found under the sun. Meaning cannot be found under the sun. If you're trying to find meaning in your life, purpose, think if the word meaning doesn't strike you, think of the word purpose or justification. If you're trying to justify yourself by your job, by your money, by your pleasure, by your family, by your wisdom, you will fail. If you're trying to justify your life by helping the poor or overturning oppression, you will fail. Wrong will only be made right when everyone stands before God in the judgment. And on that day, you will have meaning. You'll understand why you were here. You'll understand what this life was for. On that day, everyone will receive their just rewards. On that day, things will make sense to us and we'll be comforted. And until that day, remember the Lord. Remember Him. And so it's really interesting. Like I said, if you lock in on those first verses, people want to talk about this book like it's cynical, it's depressing, but it really isn't. Four different times in the book, he's going to say, so enjoy your wife, enjoy your job, enjoy food, enjoy drink, enjoy dancing, enjoy your life, just don't get meaning from it. Enjoy the good things, but don't live for them. Relieve oppression where you see it. Help the poor, but don't make the end of oppression the purpose of your existence, or you'll die having not accomplished your purpose. Enjoy music, food, drink, and love, but don't lose yourself in them, because every pleasure will fade. He's talking to us like a kind father. He's not a disillusioned artist. He's not someone who feels like he's wasted his life. He's talking to us the way He's talking to us the way Merle Haggard used to talk to us, right? His best songs. Don't live the way I lived. It's just not that great. Don't make those mistakes. Don't lose yourself. Don't throw away your youth. But live your life under the King. Enjoy what He's given you and trust Him. That's the overall introduction. And with that kind of as a background, I want that to kind of sink in with you, because I'm not going to repeat it every week. In one sense, if this is all one sermon, all I should do is just kind of read it to you and we should knock it off. But there's so much wisdom here that I really want us to spend the summer drinking it deeply. I want us to get it. There's just so much wisdom here. And it's going to be different. The sermon's going to be different, right? You know, y'all, by now y'all know I've got 650 sermons online, and I know you've listened to all of them. And so you know how I do it, right? I have one point, I say it five times. I say it at the introduction, before all three subpoints, and at the end. I have one point, I say it five times, it always ends with talking about Jesus, or it begins with talking about Jesus, or he's somewhere in the middle, or he's all about it. But it's going to be different this summer. We're going to just talk about the wisdom. And everything we're going to say is going to be against this backdrop. That the things of earth are good gifts, but they're not worth living for. And we only knowing ourselves and who we are under God's gaze, that is the only thing worth living for. And that's how we're gonna use that to look at each particular chapter. And we're gonna look at this first chapter today, and we're gonna see this. Life is a circle. It's a circle. Ignore that to your frustration, or embrace it and find peace. Life is a circle, right? Elton John taught us that. It's a circle of life. Well, how does Ecclesiastes say it? He says this: a generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. The wind blows from the south and then to the north, and around the wind goes. On its circuit, the wind returns. Streams run to the sea, but the sea's never full. To the place where the streams go, there they flow again. Over and over, everything is circular. You know, it's a bittersweet symphony, this life. We work real hard so we can make some money so we can die. We're raising children, and we're getting jobs, and we're paying bills so we can raise our children, so they can get jobs, so they can pay bills, so they can raise their children, so they can get jobs, so they can pay bills, so they can raise their children. Or you can look at the small circles, right? The everyday circles. We get out of bed and make our bed so we can unmake the bed and go to bed, so we can get out of bed and make the bed. We get up in the morning, we wash the clothes, we dry the clothes, we fold the clothes, we put the clothes away. Why? So we can find the clothes, so we can dirty the clothes, so we can wash the clothes, so we can dry the clothes. It's just circle after circle. And when you get lost in those circles, it's so frustrating. And not acknowledging that they're circles, if you don't acknowledge them, you just get destroyed by them. Because what circles do is they frustrate people who are trying to get somewhere. Like, you ever think about those poor horses at the end of a horse race? Like, they don't know where they're going, but they know they're in a hurry, right? And they've been getting whipped. And they cross the finish line, they're like, we were just here. That was the longest possible route to get here. I mean, that's kind of how life is, you know? I mean, it's a circle. And we kind of have this feeling that we're going somewhere. Have we arrived yet? There's this movie called Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. It's got Tina Fey in it. It was free on Amazon, so I watched it. Because I like her. I think she's funny. And so I assume the movie would be funny. It's not. Don't watch it. But it's about a reporter who takes on the assignment of covering the war in Afghanistan. And, you know, she's a woman in Afghanistan, which is very difficult. And she's in the middle of the war, which is very difficult. And it's about how hard that is. And she was asked at one point, why did you take this assignment? You volunteered. And she said, I've been doing the same thing every day for years. I get up, I go to the same gym, I get on the same stationary bicycle every day. I've been riding that bicycle for an hour a day, every day for 3 years. One day I looked down, and the bike had been slightly moved. It had gone back, been moved, and you could see the groove in the carpet where it had been, you know, about an inch in front of where it was now. And I realized I'd been pedaling for 3 years to go backwards one inch. That's kind of life. Have you figured that out yet? It's hard. We believe so fervently, we believe that we are in a competition. You know, every year before finals, one of my kids, at least one of them, I have to pull aside and go, I know everybody's telling you it's a competition. It's a race to nowhere. It's a race to nowhere. You're doing fine. You know, but we believe that, don't we? We got to succeed. Got to make hundreds. Got to be the best. Why? You graduate first in your class. You know what that means? You get to go to a hard, competitive school where you have to work even harder. And so you graduate first in your class. So you know what that means? You get to go to a really challenging graduate school and compete even harder. And you succeed. So you know what that means? We give you a high-pressure job. And you fulfill the project. And you know what that means? We give you a bigger project. And you had a great year this year. Which means our expectations of you are going to be higher next year. And it's going to be easier for you to fail. And you're going to keep running in that circle. And if you're trying to get somewhere by going in that circle, I got bad news. It's just the longest possible route you can take to get here. But you're going to end up in the same place. That sun's going to keep coming up every morning. You're going to grow old, and you're going to die. You're not going to extend your life by a moment. You're never going to win. You're never going to succeed. You'll succeed, but you're not going to get anywhere. If you're trying to get somewhere, it'll be frustration. It's never going to be enough. It's never going to be enough. What does he say? He says, enjoy the race. Enjoy the running. Enjoy your job. Your job is a gift from the Lord. Enjoy it. But if you're running it to get somewhere, the only place you're going to get to is disappointment. You're just going to get to disappointment. Circles frustrate and infuriate those who refuse to believe they're in one. Refuse to believe they're on a treadmill. Who refuse to believe that that's where they are. Those who believe they're getting somewhere, they're justifying their existence, end up exhausted. But that's not all the messages here. Circles are also, actually, circles are really comforting for those who expect them. You know, there's something encouraging about knowing there's nothing new under the sun. You know, it's just encouraging to have been on this spiral before, isn't it? Like, think about the first time you ever lived through a lightning storm. Like, you cried. You screamed. I mean, why wouldn't you, right? If you've never seen one of these before, lightning? Thunder from nowhere, like the loudest noise you've ever heard in your life coming from nowhere? It's terrifying. But, you know, after a while, you kind of get used to them, don't you? I got a text message from my brother the other day. Are y'all okay? Yeah, I guess. Am I not? He said, well, I saw on the news there were two tornadoes in Tulsa last night. You know, every time there's a tornado within 100 miles of here, it's in Tulsa. I said, well, I was at a concert. I missed them. You know, it's like, I don't even get the alerts on my phone anymore, right? We've seen that, and it's actually kind of, it's just encouraging to know nothing's new. You know, it's encouraging to know that everybody struggles their junior year of high school. It's encouraging to know that everybody wants to change majors when they're a sophomore in college. It's encouraging to know that everybody gets overwhelmed with their second kid. It's encouraging to know that everybody, when they hit 15 years of marriage, thinks, I can't do this another day. And you look around, you see all your friends getting divorced. Like, oh, that happens to everybody. It's kind of like, oh, I'm not the first person to be here. I'm not the first person who feels terribly unqualified to do the job of parenting. I'm not the first person to overindulge my last child and overparent my first. I'm not the first. There's just something encouraging to know that, yeah, this is just a circle. And a matter of fact, you can learn from them. Circles actually teach you how to live, if you'll let them. The fact that things keep happening the same way is actually kind of encouraging. It teaches us how to prepare for the next lap. You know, in the old days, we used to live the same spiral, right? We would plant in the spring, tend in the summer, harvest in the fall, and store up in the winter, and eat and rest. And in our case, you know, in the Jones household, what is it? It means we throw ourselves into it in September. We work very hard in September. We have a lot of birthday parties in October. We get ready. We finish well in November. December is just breakneck every night. There's something to do until December 24th. Come December 25th, we're going to rest. And we're going to rest all the way to January 31st. And then we're going to do it all again. And every April, I'm going to feel like quitting. You know how I know that? Because I called a friend of mine up a few years ago. It was in the middle, about three quarters of the way through April. I'm like, I'm so tired. I just don't know if I can keep doing this. And he started laughing. I was like, what are you laughing about? And he said, last year you called me in April and you told me, you said, when I call you next April, will you please remind me that I call you every April? And I'm like, oh yeah. Every May, I take all this tiredness out on my family and become intolerable. At the end of every May, I take a week off and rest and remember what I like about them. It's a spiral. We've done this before. It's okay. Just learn from it. We have a couple comes to first service, Paul and Cheryl Owens. They do the same thing every year. Every year, they go off for a week in the fall. You ask them where they're going. Paul's going to say, well, we're going to go save our marriage. You know, they've learned from the circles that marriages require effort and they require time, and they learn from the circles that they have time in the fall to get away, and so they go and do it. You can learn from them if you will. Circles are terrifying if you're lost. You know, if you're in the woods and you realize you've been going around in circles, it becomes terrifying. But circles save those who are in trouble. You know, I mean, to hear that there's nothing new under the sun, That is wonderful news if you're lost. That is wonderful news to know that you're not the first person who ever got addicted to pornography. You're not the first person who's ever committed adultery. You're not the first person who's ever finally admitted that you're attracted to people of the same sex. You're not the first person to get cynical and frustrated by your lack of progress. You're not the first person to get sick to death of your wife or your husband. You're not the first person to find out that you're addicted to alcohol or prescriptions. You're not the first person to find out your spouse is. As a matter of fact, every one of those things has a well-worn path. And if you're lost in the darkness, a well-worn path is salvation. You can follow other people's steps. You can get out of there. It's overwhelmingly comfortable to find this path and to see them. And I want you to know those paths are there for you. But you have to come out of hiding to find them. You got to let us know what circle you're in. I mean, it's comforting to know that other people have been there. I was at a retreat for pastors a few years ago. And it takes us about 3 days to get honest. And about the third night, I was with my prayer group. And I said, guys, honestly, I just feel like if I drank every night until I was numb, I would feel better. It would be easier, at least. And one of my friends looked at me and said, it's not all it's cracked up to be. I go to AA every night now because I used to do that. It's a well-worn path, man. I've been down that path. Let me tell you, you don't want to go down it. But if you're stuck down it, there's a path to get out of it. There's nothing new. You're not unique. I'm sorry. You're not special. And that's really good news. And the same grace and salvation that everyone else in this room has found is there for you. Come and let us help you find it. Please pray with me. Father in heaven, how great news it is to find out that we're not special. That you've seen people just like us before, and yet you know every one of us by name. Father, I pray that you give us the courage, the humility, and the strength to follow these well-worn paths, these circles, to get out of the death spirals that we're in. Give us the grace to be honest. Give us the strength to ask for help. Because you've promised not to turn down anybody who comes. Because Jesus said he would receive everyone who came to him and raise them up on the final day. Would you give us that hope now, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.